This is an ABC podcast. You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, I am Cassie, up with you for The Country Hour today. Now, it's not far from seeding, so have you bought a new tractor recently or maybe some machinery? If you have, you're not alone. Machinery sales are just going gangbusters.
Sales are very strong right across the country. Sales are strong across all categories, not just large equipment that's been geared towards harvesting, and we think there's still life in this bubble yet.
Still life in this bubble. I'll have more on why soon. We've canvassed this quite a lot on the Country Hour, but if you are perhaps buying up some machinery, give me a text 0467922891 or phone 1300 222 891. I'd be interested to know what you are looking at buying. But to water now, because it's an important time of year for South Australian irrigators. The state government has today announced the minimum water allocation irrigators can use for the next water year. So from July this year to June next year. Minister of Environment and Water David Speirs has made the announcement. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cathy.
So what will the opening allocation, the minimum opening allocation be for the River Murray irrigators this year?
Well, the projected minimum opening allocation is 82% for the new water year starting on the 1st of July. 82% is the highest projection we've had during my 3 years as minister. In every other year, we've got to 100% regardless of the low projection. I'm quite confident as you could be of getting to 100% during next water year. I think the storages are looking good, the weather patterns are looking good, and when we feed all our information in and the modelling from the Bureau of Meteorology, etc., it's all looking very, very strong in terms of allocations going into the new water year.
So this is a guarantee that the water allocation will not drop below 82% for permanent water security holders in South Australia.
That is correct. And many of your listeners would know that conditions are pretty good out there at the moment. We know what has happened in the other parts of the basin in terms of fairly decent rainfall. Storages have got reasonable levels and the trajectory is good.
The usefulness, though, of this early minimum allocation announcement, though, was questioned last year when it was, this time last year, you announced a 2% minimum allocation, and in the end it did reach 100%. Are you still concerned about the usefulness of doing this?
Well, I can tell you the usefulness was questioned by a lot of people, no more so than me, because, you know, we go out there with 2% and everyone says, what is going on? It's greatly disturbing for irrigators. And then within weeks last year, we were up to 20%, 30%, 40%, and we got to 100 very quickly because really the weather patterns changed significantly, likely off the back of La Nina and that weather pattern emerging in a global sense. So, look, irrigators continue to tell me that they want this modelling, they want these figures up front. It enables them most years to get a very clear idea, to make investment decisions, to make decisions around what they'll do with their crops and their perennial plantings, how they'll manage them, but particularly around business certainty and making financial investment decisions, deciding if they need to buy water and how they will play the market. So irrigators tell me this is still useful, and so we're continuing on with it. And as I mentioned, an 82% open and minimum allocation is good news for irrigators.
Having the minimum opening allocation greater than 50% means that the carryover trigger for 2021 to 2022 has not been met. So that means that any water volumes that were rolled over from the previous water year won't be able to be used after July 1, 2021. Have you fielded much concern from growers about this?
Growers do get a bit concerned about this because it is a you know, it is seen as losing water that they essentially put in their back pocket for use down the track. However, you know, that's part of managing life as an irrigator and as a trader on the water market. And most of our growers, if not all of them, understand that they do run a bit of a gauntlet with regard to that. And it is part of life as an irrigator, I suppose. They can be confident, though, that things are looking very good across the basin, as good as they have done for the last 4 or 5 years. And from an economic and productivity point of view, they should be heartened.
I'm speaking to Water Minister David Spears about the opening water allocation for South Australia. Now, the South Australian carryover policy has been criticised by South Australian irrigators, and a recent ACCC report recommended that South Australia should update its registers and trade forms on the carryover rules and trade forms to be able to identify some of the carryover parking trades and things like that. This was recommendation 16 from the big ACCC look at water markets in Australia, or in the Murray-Darling Basin, I should say. Do you think this policy does need an overhaul, this carryover policy?
Yeah, look, that's certainly something we want to take a look at. There's a desire to see consistent carryover policies. The ACCC report was certainly made some substantial reading, 709 pages of it, and there were lots of positives there. South Australia is very keen to ensure that we have our house in order with regard to all our dealings when it comes to water and the water market. We're constantly examining our rules, and we are extremely open to modernising them and refining them, and I've asked my team to take a good look at that.
So you are looking at updating the registers and trade forms?
Yes. Yeah, we will take a look at that as part of our state-based response to the ACCC report. So there's a whole range of things, cross-state recommendations, and then some for each state as well at an individual state level. And we'll look at the macro ones across the states and work with other states. But we'll be looking at the carryover rules in South Australia to see if we can make improvements to those. We think we've improved them in recent years. We have made changes there, but there's more work to be done.
As part of this announcement, the government is releasing a personal water calculator. What is this and how will it work?
Yeah, this is quite an exciting little initiative that's come out of the Environment Department as part of our ongoing desire to provide more information to irrigators in South Australia. So the River Murray Water Calculator has two main features. It's firstly, there's a personal water calculator to help irrigators understand how much water that they could have under different circumstances to plan the season ahead, and they can plug various scenarios into the calculator to make decisions on where to buy water, how to buy water, and how to manage their irrigation strategies. And then secondly, it also includes the state water calculator to help irrigators better understand how water available to South Australia is shared at the macro level, so how water comes into the state via the River Murray and how that is divvied up amongst the various different license types, from irrigators to Adelaide drinking water and commercial water users and the like. So it's a very nice tool, and I would encourage your listeners to get onto the Department for Environment and Water's website and check out that calculator. Our aim is to try and lift literacy and knowledge and understanding around water use and help people make savvy business decisions. And this just is another tool that will hopefully aid that.
Well, thank you for your time today, Minister. I dare say there'll be a few more allocation announcements before the actual water year starts on July 1, 2021. But this is a much higher allocation than this time last year, so I'm sure that that is promising for the rest of the state.
Yeah, I think many irrigators will be heartened and relieved by this announcement. So thank you for having me today, Cathy.
Minister for Environment and Water, David Spears. Now, what do irrigators make of this announcement? You can let me know yourself on 0467922891 with a text, or you can call 1300 222 891 as well. Rosalie Arrick is the General Manager of Renmark Irrigation Trust. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So how welcome is this guarantee now that irrigators will get at least 82% of their allocation for the next water year?
It sounds to me like a good news and bad news announcement. We're very pleased that we have a minimum allocation of 82% because that gives our irrigators confidence to move into the next water year and the next season. However, we are concerned about the private carryover arrangement, and I was very pleased to hear the Minister say that he's willing to look at making further refinement to that. For your listeners who aren't fully aware, this announcement means that our irrigators who conserve water and save it for future security have again lost their water, which is the second year that this has happened. And it is very distressing for the irrigators for that to occur.
This last year was a bit of a different circumstance though, wasn't it? Because you did open below the 50% last year, 2%. It was very low last year. So it's a different scenario this year, isn't it?
It's a different scenario. Last year we sought some improvements, and the Minister mentioned that some improvements had been made, which was to roll over the private carryover. But because that announcement is greater than 50%, that water has again been lost.
Does it make sense, though, that it not carry over, given that if say, water was to be carried over and then there is a lower water year, would that additional carryover not put extra stress on a river system that is suffering from low flows at that time?
Look, I think we need to understand that carryover is simply a tool that is recommended by the ACCC. It's been recommended by numerous government reports as a way of managing water availability risk. And our state has a very conservative policy. However, carryover is a way for people to conserve water. There are people who don't do that will either be using all of their water or parking it interstate. There is a tool available to park spare water interstate, but it's really a book process, and it pays brokers and it pays people in Victoria. So our growers would have to, by the 30th of June, shift their water to Victoria and then in July bring it back onto the South Australian licence. So it is very much a paper entry, and the water, you know, part of the water entitlement is you are able to use your water 100%. That's a part of the water allocation plan in South Australia. If we get to 100%, you're entitled to use that. And I must say, the state water calculator that has been launched today is really, really good. It does show in a simple way what happens to the water for the South Australian entitlement from the Murray-Darling Basin Authority.
I was going to ask you about that, what you thought of that calculator. So you think that will be useful for farmers?
I think it's the actual South Australian Water Allocation Plan is quite a thick document and takes a little bit of digesting. This is a simple one page up on the website, and you can see how the water is shared in the state, so you can see the Class 3 water entitlements and the percentage depending for various scenarios of the South Australian entitlement. So it is, I think it's a great tool. It simplifies a very thick document down to one page.
So it sounds like you're still not thinking, even despite those changes, that the carryover policy is still not really fit for purpose. I did have it described to me earlier today that this announcement is a bit like sucking on a lemon. You know, it's good for you. You're getting your full. You're probably going to get your full allocation, but you're not all that happy about it. It's probably not going to make you smile.
No, I think it is. I absolutely agree with that. I think it is. I think if you put yourself in the shoes of an irrigator, they are really worried. They've got, most of them have permanent crops, and they want their water security. We know we have high security entitlements in South Australia, but most people would like to put some water aside for those dry years. If you think of it as a household budget, you know, all the budget advisors say, put some finances aside, put some cash aside for those emergencies. And then most people can sleep well at night. Well, that's how our irrigators feel. If they could just put some water aside, knowing that it's there in case water allocations are less than 100%, they can sleep at night. It's for their well-being. It's about securing your business. And we don't have a fit-for-purpose private carryover policy in South Australia yet.
However,
the Minister did say that he's open to refinement, so we will take him up on that.
And we'll keep following it. Thanks for your thoughts today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was the General Manager of Renmark Irrigation Trust, Rosalie Urich, speaking there. It's 20 past 12 here on the Country Hour. We'll move away from water to machinery now, because if you've bought a tractor recently, you would not be alone, because tractor sales have surged by a massive 64% across Australia in March when compared to the same month last year. Tractor and Machinery Association of Australia Executive Director Gary Northover says in the 12 months, more than 15,000 tractors have been sold.
Sales are very strong right across the country. Sales are strong across all categories, not just large equipment that's been geared towards harvesting. And we think there's still life in this bubble yet.
Tractor sales you've recorded for March were up 64% on the same month last year. And in the last 12 months, there's been more than 15,000 tractors sold across Australia, which is 40% higher than the previous 12 months. So those figures, I guess, say a lot about how well things are going.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's certainly well above, you know, recent trends. I think we've been saying that that's probably the biggest 12-month period since the 1980s. So it's been very strong.
And in particular, is there a category or power range of tractors that are most in demand at the moment?
Well, for a period there, it was the smaller range, I guess, which was the sweet spot of the government's instant asset write-off scheme. And certainly availability of larger tractors had been a bit of a challenge, but in the last few months it's been really evenly spread across the board. The 200 horsepower plus range has been very strong, and we're seeing all categories that we report to be at very high levels.
And in the information that the TMA has put out, that you've noted that New South Wales is leading the charge with 98% up on the same time last year with the tractor sales. So I guess, does that speak volumes about the type of cropping season that a lot of farmers have had in the New South Wales?
Yeah, no doubt. And I think it also highlights the depth of the drought that New South Wales went through. I think it was probably, you know, the most extreme in the country. So the recovery there has been wonderful. We hope that, yeah, all farmers and dealers have enjoyed it evenly. Clearly, things were pretty bad 12 months or more ago there, and better days here with us today.
And do you think what's also helping to drive the sales is that livestock producers, dairy producers might have a bit more cash freed up because they're not having to buy in as much feed as they had been during the drought years also?
I think it's across the board. I mean, their demand for their, you know, product has been very strong. I think we talked before about Australian consumers' desire for locally produced product and this whole notion of food security. So that's been driving demand, and performance of the industry has been healthy. That's allowed farmers to reinvest, supported by the government incentives. So I think there's never been a better time to be reinvesting in plant equipment, and people are taking advantage of that.
And the federal government's instant asset write-off scheme is set to end at the end of June. So do you expect there'll be a big buy-up before then, and then things might drop away in the spending once that's off the table?
Look, I mean, you'd almost need to be a tax accountant to interpret this, but it seems to me that there is a follow-on likely in the form of increased allowances for depreciation write-offs, which means that it may not be a sudden end that we initially thought it was going to be, that the instant asset write-off scheme is to be replaced by other incentives, so for a further 12 months. So we really think that whilst at some point the market's got to slow a bit, it just can't keep absorbing a product at the rate it has been, the conditions will still be attractive for people to continue to invest. just not sure at what level.
And speaking of that product, with COVID-19 still continuing, has there been any issues getting the parts and new gear here that people want to buy?
There's no doubt that the second half of the year has been a challenge. At the beginning of this run, there was stock aplenty. Dealers had stock to burn. But today, lead times have stretched out. And I think it's meant that if a customer has a particular spec in mind, he may need to compromise. He or she may need to compromise on what it is they ultimately buy.
Tractor Machinery Association of Australia Executive Director Gary Northover speaking there to Cara Jeffrey. And out of interest, the tractor sales in South Australia for March were up 14% on the same month last year. But in Western Australia, they're up 70% on the last month. So they've really been putting their hand in their pocket over there in the West. There's a few things, as they outlined there, that have been driving that. We'll take a look at what's happening in weather, though. Now I'm joined by Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology, Tom Bowick. Good afternoon.
Hello, Cassie.
So what's happening around the state?
Yeah, okay. Well, look, we're sort of continuing with this southwest to southwesterly airstream that we've had with us for a few days now. There was some showers in the last 24 hours with rainfall totals generally between, say 1 and 5 millimetres over the southern agricultural area. Most of those falls are on the lower end of that in the more northern parts there. So a little bit around. And at the moment, we still have some shower activity visible on our radars. And it's mostly sort of confined again to the southern agricultural area. Sort of a slight to medium chance of those showers, probably more likely if you're in the lower southeast there. That'll sort of continue for the rest of today. As we move into Friday then, we've got a little bit of different weather coming into sort of the more western parts of the state. There's an upper level feature sort of moving across from the or extending from the southwest, let's say, and that's going to just destabilise the atmosphere a little bit. So actually got a chance of a thunderstorm for the Eyre Peninsula area for tomorrow, also the southern bits of the northwest pastoral, perhaps into the Flinders and sort of northern parts of the mid-north and the northern parts of the York Peninsula there as well. There's just a chance it could be a possible rumble in that area there. Not expecting a lot in that, but nevertheless, there is a chance. For the rest of the state, there's a slight to medium chance of showers over the central and western districts. Also looking at some early fogs to be around as well for Friday. Then into Saturday, that upper level feature will have moved out and away from us, so any thunderstorms would have cleared away certainly well by then. There's still going to be some morning fogs and possibly some frost patches around for Saturday morning as well. And any showers look like being confined to mostly the coastal areas for Saturday. For Sunday, there's a weak front that moves over the southern coast. So once again, showers extending over the southern agricultural area, tending towards or a slight to medium chance of those, and perhaps a high chance if you're in the lower southeast. Some morning fogs are likely again on Sunday, as they are on Monday as well. Looks like at this stage for that period, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then into Thursday, there will be shower activity sort of continuing for the southern agricultural area from time to time. There is a couple of fronts sort of embedded in there that will be moving over the south. So rainfall not really reaching too far north, perhaps the odd light shower for the northern agricultural area, but mostly it's going to be confined to the southern agricultural area through that period there. Now, just to finish off there, as far as the cumulative rainfall totals are concerned, so the period is from now until midnight on Monday, we're thinking 2 to 5 millimetres for the southern agricultural area, less than 2 millimetres for the northern agricultural area and the Eyre Peninsula, the south of the northwest pastoral, and also the far north of the state. There's still some residual moisture up there producing some showers perhaps for today and overnight. There's a possibility of some totals of 5 to 10 millimetres for the southern coasts, also the southern Mount Lofty ranges, and also in the lower southeast district. So that's about it from me. Back to you, Cassie.
Thanks so much for that, Tom. That was Tom Bowick from the Bureau of Meteorology there with the weather forecast. For the far west of New South Wales, the upper western is going to be partly cloudy, overnight temperatures down to 11 to 15, but during the day it'll reach the low to mid-20s. And the lower western will be mostly sunny, very similar temperature range, 8 to 11 at night, and reach the low 20s during the day. It's really lovely temperatures for that part of the world at this time of the year, so it might be worth a visit to the far west of New South Wales. Keep listening to the program, though, because I'm going to have more on why you could be paying more for beef at your butcher shop. Keep listening. Right now, though, it is coming up to 12:30, and we'll have more shortly.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff. Cassie Huff.
Hi, I'm so glad you could join me this afternoon. I am Cassie Huff, and I'm wondering if you're like me. You love almonds. They're a pretty popular nut in South Australia, and South Australia is a big producer of them. But it seems that it won't be too hard to get your hands on South Australian nuts this year. I'll have more on how the harvest has gone in the next 15 minutes. Also, I'll bring you some breakthrough research that's found some striking similarities between glyphosate resistance in plants and cancer drug resistance in humans.
A great deal of similarity between cancer cells in humans using a gene that codes for a transporter that pumps cancer drugs out of the cells and a similar transporter pumping glyphosate out of this plant and thereby giving glyphosate resistance.
Bit of cross-pollination of plant research and human research there. Some really interesting information coming your way in the next 10 minutes on that. But first, we have to find out what's happening in news with Wendy Glamacek. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie. In the news this hour, Australia's jobless rate has dropped again as the economy rebounds from the coronavirus pandemic. The unemployment rate fell 5.6% rather in March from 5.8% in February in seasonally adjusted terms. The lack of safety provided to nurses working for the Nanapar Health Council in the APY lands has been condemned by a coronial inquest into the murder of Outback nurse Gail Woodford. Mrs. Woodford was abducted, raped and murdered by Dudley Davey in March of 2016 after he sought medical care from her house in Freegon where she was working on call alone. Today, the state's deputy coroner handed down 12 recommendations, including that the NHC ensure that on-call staff are always accompanied and that patients no longer attend nurses' homes. And extra sites are being set up in Adelaide South and North to accelerate the COVID-19 vaccination program. They'll be at the Playford Civic Centre in Elizabeth and the Old Masters site in Noarlunga. Both will aim to provide 3,000 vaccinations each week. More ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Wendy. Now, the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator has passed the 900 cents a kilogram mark for the first time in history. Now, this indicator basically tells you how expensive meat will be in your butcher shop because young cattle are the main cattle that you'll find served up at your butcher shop or in your supermarket, wherever you buy your beef. It means that the beef in Australia is at its most expensive price ever. And I'd be interested to know if you have noticed this increased price at your butcher shop or your supermarket. Text me on 0467 922 891 or call 1300 222 891. Now, if you compare it to this time last year, it's almost 200 cents or $2 a kilogram more expensive than this time last year. So it's been a pretty steep rise. Angus Verley from the ABC spoke to Matt Dalglish from Thomas Elder Markets about this historic occasion.
I guess it was something that we'd been looking at for a while. We'd kind of expected at some stage, given the northern rains we'd seen, that we could see this move above 900 cents. We briefly nearly got there a week or so ago. We got to 896 and then it backed away a little bit. But I just think that intent to restock is just too strong, particularly in those parts of the north now. And they're kind of getting some rain too and they've taken off a bit. So it's kind of pushed along.
So for you, is it just a natural consequence of excellent seasonal conditions, a restocker demand, and feedlotter demand, all of those things coming together?
That's right, and obviously the very tight supply we've had for the last few years, you know, lowest herd in nearly 30 years, I think it is, Angus. So, that's a combination of all those factors that you've just outlined that have really got the rocket under in particular young cattle prices.
What does it mean for the different players in the supply chain when we have got cattle prices so high? Because we have heard a lot from processors in recent times saying that these prices aren't sustainable. So what does it mean for the whole supply chain?
Oh, a great question, actually, and it's very timely because on Thomas Elder Markets we just put up our beef processor margin model for March, and that's shown exactly what the processors have been saying, that it's a very tough environment. It's obviously not just young cattle prices that are at record highs. We're also seeing pretty high prices all across the, you know, the cattle types, and indeed right the way through to finished steers. So that's meant that, you know, along the supply chain, particularly for processors, it's a very difficult time, and the margin showing for the last 3 months, they've been losing in excess of $300 per head of animal slaughtered, according to that model. So the kind of, I guess, the worst margins we've seen on a monthly basis for as long as that particular model goes back to, which is the 2000s.
And now we hear processors say that they can't sustain these prices. So will we see processors drop out?
Look, if you look back historically, and AMPC did a really good work on a similar type model to the one Thomas Elder Markets used in terms of theoretical beef processor, and they compared times when we had negative margin and what happened to processors when they were extended periods of negative margin, and it definitely lines up with that analysis that shows processors did actually close down. And, you know, some for a temporary, you know, kind of situation, but obviously some closed down permanently. I think as this extends, we're certainly going to see some of the temporary windbacks and reducement of shifts and stuff, which we're already seeing. Indeed, some lines in Victoria for some abattoirs have shifted down from 3 lines to 1. I'd expect for some of the maybe smaller, less efficient processes, it's going to be a really tough decision that they're facing in the next few months.
You touched on it there, Matt, but where do you expect prices to trend as we go through the winter months?
In May, actually, is the time when prices kind of tend to ease a little bit seasonally, and then we start to pick up again as we go through into kind of the depth of winter. But I suspect with this rain we're seeing, just how tight the supply is, we may not see that easing in May. I think we might just go straight into a bit of a winter creep. They're very high prices, though, Angus. I think if you look back, and we did some work a few weeks back on Thomas Elder Markets to inflation adjust the young cattle price, going back to the 1960s. And so, you know, making the prices into current day dollar values effectively. And if you look back then, there were a few occasions where we did get above 900 cents in inflation adjusted terms. And indeed, the peak was back in 1965 when we reached 936 cents in current dollar value. So I guess that's the next real benchmark is do we see this year that we test to those inflation adjusted all-time highs. I suspect around that 920 to 930 level we will start to get some significant price pressure to, you know, resistance, I guess, just because the finished year hasn't really continued to move higher with the ECI, and at the end of the day, people that are running the numbers are going to look at this and say it's just not becoming economic, even for grass-fed, you know, kind of operations to buy young cattle up at those levels and hope they're going to turn a profit when time for, you know, they're going to turn those steers off or those cattle off. So I suspect we're within about 20 to 30 cents of a top anyway.
That was Matt Dalgleish, who is the manager of Commodity Market Insights at Thomas Elder Markets. He was speaking with Angus Verley. So by the sounds of things, it's a good situation if you're selling, but not so good if you're buying, whether you're trying to buy cattle or you're just trying to buy beef at the shop. And that is reflected in a text from Angela, who says that people on limited incomes can't afford meat anymore. Even lamb chops are unaffordable now, so she's moved to eating more vegetables. So I think lamb almost made the move before beef did to really become quite an expensive meat. If you are finding these red meat prices to be just pushing you a bit too far, or maybe you think that it's good that the farmers are getting a good price after tough years, text me 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. Now moving to cropping, because there's been a major breakthrough in glyphosate resistance research, and it's coming from a rather unusual source. So you're probably familiar with resistance, with glyphosate being used. There are plants that are no longer dying when the chemical is applied to them. Well, scientists at the Australian Herbicide Resistance Initiative have recently proven that these plants that are resistant have these pumps in their cells that can pump the glyphosate into the space in between and survive. And it has some really striking similarities to the cancer drug resistance that's seen in humans sometimes. University of Western Australia Emeritus Professor and AHRI founder Stephen Powers says the research has significant international implications.
It's a long story, and the story is focused on a population of the weed known as barnyard grass from Kununurra region up there in the northwest irrigation area, where they were using glyphosate repeatedly, and this Echinochloa population developed evolved resistance to glyphosate, and we have been working on it now for close to a decade. And the reason that we're also excited about it is because of one of the resistance mechanisms that we found. Now, to change subjects for a minute, in human cancer, it's known that one of the mechanisms that cancers, tumour cells in humans can become resistant to the drugs, the anti-cancer drugs, is due to the ability of human tumour cancerous cells to pump various anti-cancer drugs out of the cells, and therefore they survive and the tumour lives and the patient may die. And though that has been well studied for some time, and it's due to pumps which sit on the membranes of the cells and can pump these anti-cancer drugs out of cancer cells. And what we have found in this glyphosate-resistant plant from Kununurra is that it is a very, very similar transporter on the membrane of these plant cells that can pump glyphosate out of the cells and give them glyphosate resistance. So, Tara, a great deal of similarity between cancer cells in humans using a gene that codes for a transporter that pumps cancer drugs out of the cells and a similar transporter pumping glyphosate out of this plant and thereby giving glyphosate resistance. So I'm sure you and your listeners can understand why we're so excited about it, because of this similarity in mechanisms between cancer and herbicide resistance.
Was this a natural link, Steve? I mean, was this something that you had thought about for some time?
Indeed, I had thought about it for a long time and did some early work, but I don't want to take anything away from others on this paper. The first author is a fantastic young Chinese researcher called Lang Pan, who came here for a year supported by the China Scholarship Council. And he is a top researcher and working with our top researchers here in ARI, Quinn Yu and Herping Han, who are researchers here in ARI, and others. And some of it is highly sophisticated, Tara. And the honest fact is I couldn't do it myself with my own hands, but Lang Pan was able to do this work. So working closely with Yu Xing here in ARI, this work has occurred. So we're really proud of it.
So, Steve, given that you have found this mechanism in barnyard grass, do you expect that it would exist in other species and other cereal species?
We do. We're going to initiate research now to look to see how much this mechanism is occurring in ryegrass, because we've got hundreds, if not thousands, of ryegrass populations that are resistant to glyphosate. So we're going to look for it in ryegrass, and we're going to look for it in other glyphosate resistance as well. And I expect that now this paper's published in PNS, there'll be researchers around the world who'll go, wow, we're going to look for this now. They've got the ability to do so once this paper's published. And so it'll pretty quickly be evident how much this is occurring around the world.
Can you lean on some of your colleagues in the medical research field to go forward with possible ways to combat this pump that pumps the glyphosate out into those spaces between the cells?
Oh, Tara, to be fair, I don't have what it takes to lean on these cancer researchers, but what they tell me is that this discovery of this transporter pumping anti-cancer drugs out of cancerous cells, what it forced was the design of new anti-cancer drugs that the pump can't work on. And so any good current modern anti-cancer drug is not affected by these pumps. So there's no doubt there'll be herbicide discovery chemists that from today onwards will be thinking, I wonder what I can design in terms of a new herbicide that this pump doesn't work on. But that's a long bow that I'm drawing. That's years and years and years of research. I don't want to make out that this research is going to solve the problem of glyphosate. It won't. But it's fundamental research, and all advances are based on knowledge of what's really going on. And what we've done is add a really important new chapter to our understanding about how plants can resist glyphosate.
And the fact that it's been published in PNAS, I suppose, just shows its international significance, this discovery.
Absolutely. In my long research career, which is, you know, over 40 years now, this is only the second paper that I'm an author on in PNAS. It's really, really hard to publish in PNAS because they set such high standards and they'll only take work that's got broad scientific interest. And no doubt what attracted them to this paper was this similarity between resistance to cancer in humans and resistance to glyphosate in plants.
Emeritus Professor and the Australian Herbicide Resistance Initiative founder Stephen Powell speaking there to Tara de Landgraaft. And if you'd like more details, go to abc.net.au/rural, where there's more information there on that breakthrough in resistance research. Now, I've been talking about how the price of beef is going up. It's reached its most expensive, not so much in relative terms, but the actual most expensive price in history in Australia, as long as the records have been kept. Now, Dazza has texted in to say that he's been noticing people buying sausages lately and cuts of meat being looked at and then put back on the shelf after looking at prices. He's saying the desire's there, but it is starting to reach the point where average families have to reconsider and perhaps look at mince and sausages. If that is you, give me a call on 1300 222 891 or text 0467 922 891. Phil agrees, saying the price of everything's going up. He just got his car rego, it's gone up. And things need to go up or else farmers wouldn't be making any money as well. Exactly. Farmers still have to pay rego and things like that as well. But I've got a caller, Amanda, who has some thoughts on the beef price. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Yes, I just wanted to add my voice to what the other callers have said, that, you know, we have a business producing beef, which we love. We have to make a profit too. And for many years, it wasn't worth being a beef farmer, you know. But for once, we're actually getting a profit, you know. And, you know, they all scream because, the people in tourism at the moment aren't making any money. Well, for years they've said it was fine for us not to make any money. Now we're making some money and they're screaming, oh, it's too much, we can't afford it. How often do they say on the shows about health, eat a small amount of meat? You don't need to have a huge amount of meat if you can't afford it. You only need a small amount. So, you know, like if beef goes up in price, everything has gone up in price. Why do we not have to go up in price?
It does seem that inflation is something that economists are talking about. There's a lot of money swirling around in the community at the moment, so there's a lot of factors playing into this.
I know, there is. That's very true. And they just need to remember that it is a product like anyone else. And we do the best we can by our cows and look after them as best we can, which just costs money.
Thanks so much for your comments, Amanda. That was Amanda there speaking about the story we had on earlier about beef price and how the beef indicator has reached its highest point. It is 12 minutes to one.
Get your garden in shape with the May issue of ABC Gardening Australia magazine. Check out the most romantic roses, pick up tips for growing garlic, and learn how to prune with confidence. And in ABC Organic Gardener magazine, it's all about colourful carrots, healthy chooks, and foraging for tasty mushrooms. Gardening Australia and Organic Gardener magazines. Available from newsagents and abcmagazines.com.au.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, if you like your almonds, you'll be pleased to hear that South Australian almond growers have produced a large crop this year. However, in good news for consumers and perhaps not so good news for growers, the prices of the popular nut have taken a hit, which is, I guess, a bit different to what we were speaking about earlier. But it seems trade disruptions and California's large almond crop are some of the reasons for this lower price. The Australian Nut Industry Council Chair and the CEO of Century Orchards, Brendan Sadu, says while the industry is facing some challenges, he is confident about the future.
We are all but finished what we call our first harvest. We've got one variety, Monterey, which is still a little bit too wet to pick up, and it's running about 8-9%, but hopefully by the end of this week that'll definitely be wrapped up and in bunkers. We are now commencing our what we call our second shake, which is really just a clean-up of any almonds that we may have left behind. It's also part of our hygiene process. So I would say that most growers will finish harvest that I've spoken to by the end of this week. We've been blessed with the weather, with the lack of rain, particularly over here in South Australia, which has helped us. As far as yield goes, we think our yields are up from last year, which is very pleasing for us. It was a little bit unexpected, so we were hopeful that the yields were going to be up, but they definitely look like what's coming in with the limited processing we've done looks very good.
Why do you think yields have been higher this season?
I just think we've had a really good growing period. It's been cooler, and obviously the winter was wetter, so the trees haven't stressed as much. I think a lot of the management tools that we are using these days, monitoring the trees, you know, feeding them what they need, making sure we get enough carbohydrates in pre and post harvest is helping us, and it was just an exceptionally good growing year.
What have some of the challenges this season been?
Particularly the guys in the state have had challenges with range, which we haven't had. You know, we've had a pretty low pressure year from disease here in South Australia. I mean, there's always pressure. There was some pressure to try and get some fungicide on earlier, but really we've been blessed with a very good season.
In regards to getting almonds to export markets, we've heard earlier this year that there were some issues in regards to getting hold of enough shipping containers. What does trade for almonds currently look like and getting it transported to these export markets?
Yeah, absolutely. Trying to get freight is challenging. You really have to plan a couple of months out to try and book those containers so that we can load them and get them on ships and get them out. The other thing, of course, is freight costs have just gone through the roof, you know, almost double. So that is also a challenge. But as long as you get your planning in place and hopefully you've got your processing and packaging in place, you know, you're really looking 2 to 3 months ahead is what you need to do.
And with freight costs going higher, what does that mean for growers and processors here in Australia?
I guess what it means to the poor old grower is that, you know, that's a reduction in price at farm gate. And we've got challenges anyway with pricing this year, with the Californians having such a big crop last year. So prices are going to probably come off by at least, I would say, 20% from last year. So, you know, there's some challenges ahead. However, it seems to be changing daily at the moment. So I think this year's crop, 2021 crop, will definitely have lower pricing than we have probably the last few years, but I'm hopefully by 22 that we'll start building markets and hopefully the price will lift again.
The Australian almond industry is still expecting to see higher crops due to new plantings coming on and bearing a crop. What is the industry doing to diversify markets or like expanding existing markets?
So the Almond Board of Australia is working pretty closely with the Australian government. We're trying to obviously work on some free trades with Europe and obviously with Britain now. It's decided to leave the EU. So that's one thing. The other thing is obviously working, again, free trade with India. And I know traditionally India has been our largest market, however, export market. However, the last few years we have been looking at China. I know we are, as an industry, now starting to ship to India again. And obviously the Almond Board has put in some place. We're looking at new markets, Indonesia, etc., trying to open up some new markets, Taiwan. The ones that are closest to us, I guess, we're just trying to have a look at the Asia-Pacific area to see whether we can get some more almonds into those countries.
Brendan Sadoo, CEO of Century Orchards in Loxton, speaking to Jessica Schremer. And while I'm talking nuts, it's walnut harvesting season as well. Central Victorian producers Mark and Hilary Jankelson are busy removing nets and using mechanical shakers to drop their nuts. But this year, heavy rain has caused walnut blight and the pair actually lost nearly half their crop. And they say it's a nationwide problem.
Today we are taking nets off the trees. We are an unusual walnut orchard in that we net our trees because of potential cockatoo damage, which it's an all or nothing here. And today we're taking the nets off, and then as soon as they're off, we will be shaking the trees and harvesting the walnuts.
It looks quite a big task in front of you. How many trees are here and how many nets are you removing?
Well, there's 6,000 trees here, but there are about 60 nets at the moment, 60, 70 nets that we're taking off. So it's several days' work, just getting the nets off and then harvesting the walnuts.
And Hilary, I heard it's your first year driving the tractor and you're doing a really good job at the moment.
This particular job, one needs to be aware of what's going on with the trees, what's going on with the birds, and what's going on with the boys running up and down, making sure the nets are free to be rolled back onto the spindles. Yes, that's it.
We've had several tractor drivers over the years, but Hilary is by far the best driver.
And what's your season been like generally?
It's been pretty average, largely because of the big wet in September, October, November last year. Walnuts don't like being wet, and it promotes growth of a fungal infection called walnut blight, or black spot as some people call it, and that's really decimated the crop. So it was looking good until then.
Have you had blight before on the walnuts?
Very little here on this orchard. We have another orchard in the Murray Valley where we've had a lot more. But this is very, very unusual for us. But I'm told from other growers and reports that this affected walnut growers all over Australia, or southeast Australia. And some orchardists didn't even harvest, so they wrote off the whole crop.
How much of your crop was lost to this?
Oh, it's got to be at least 50%.
No, I'll say 40%. Well, it is, you know. There's very much more than I thought there was going to be from Mark getting depressed driving around. I think the other thing that has to be pointed out is that because of the rain too, it was pouring with rain when the trees were actually in full flower. And walnuts are wind pollinated. So the wind had to come through and it lifts the pollen and moves it on to the next trees. The problem being that the pollen was so heavy because it was so wet that I think that caused us a bit of pollination problems.
Yes, agree.
And I remember coming here this time last year and you were tearing your hair out from the cockatoos causing damage to the trees. What have you done this year to combat that?
Well, the netting is a huge contributor to that because we're not using the same sort of netting as vineyards. It's a much stronger netting that comes out of the fishing industry, and the cockies can't bite through it, so they land on top and then they can't get at the nuts, which is a great help. The other thing about the netting, though, which we haven't had to deal with this year because, as Mark commented, we haven't had the heat, is that the nets actually protect the nuts from the sunburn as well. But we haven't had to combat that this year.
We've just acquired a new piece of technology. It's a laser bird scarer called AVIX. And it's being used in vineyards around the world. It was developed in Holland. And we're trialling it here on our orchard. It's basically a laser that moves at great speed across the tops of the trees, and it scares the birds because it's an analogy would be you stepping into the street and seeing a big truck and saying, oh, I better get out the way. That's how the cockatoos, the birds. But we're experimenting because it requires a bit of adjustment, but we can see that in places where it is working well, the cockies land and then they fly off. So that's our big hope for next season, and we're really very keen to see that work.
Central Victorian producers Mark and Hilary Jankelson speaking there with Eden Henninen. And just on the topic we've been chatting about today, text in saying it's about time farmers had good prices for cattle. It's a reward for sticking in the industry when everyone else was getting out due to low prices and the work involved. The buyers certainly weren't complaining when they were getting cattle cheap. And a similar idea, I think it's fine for farmers to earn a profit. However, they should also understand that their biggest earner is property. And if they farm it well and improve that land, that is their greatest asset. Also, someone saying, I now eat beef once a fortnight and change down from twice a week. I guess being a bit more flexible with that. Thanks for your text there, Kath. Very quickly, Sonia Feldhoff, in 10 seconds, what's coming up?
Cassie, we're going to be checking down with that rally and where we've moved on Aboriginal deaths in custody in the last 30 years.
Thanks for that, Sonia. That was a little bit of a quick intro there. That's all we have time for in the program. It's coming up to 1 o'clock.
Leading news and current affairs.
There are so many ways to keep informed.
On air.
Online.
On the ABC Listen app.
It's actually shocked both sides or all sides of Parliament.
ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.